back in this city. I'm going to use this microphone. Can you hear me?
Yes, good.
I'm very pleased to be here and to talk to you. I think my talk will pick up, interestingly, quite a lot of the themes from that playlist, which I wasn't expecting and which I enjoyed. So you'll see these kind of themes running through my talk, and I hope that this will start the kind of debates that I imagine you will want to have in the course of this conference. I'm going to start my talk with a quotation which is taken from a collection of narratives on work which was edited some while ago by oral historian Ronald Fraser, and you can see the quotation. "Frankly, I hate work. Of course, I could say with equal truth that I love work, that it is a supremely interesting activity, that it's often fascinating, that I wish I didn't have to do it, that I wish I had a job at which I could earn a decent wage. That's six subjective statements about work, and all of them are true for me." Now, although this was written by an unemployed miner back in the 1960s, it seems to me to be very true for many people today, and to reflect the ambiguity we feel in our society about work. On the one hand, it appears to us as a necessary evil, Adam's curse, something we moan about to our friends and families. "Another bad day at the office," we say as we get home. "Where are my slippers and my drink?" But on the other hand, it's something that possesses and obsesses us. It's a major preoccupation. It integrates us into the social whole, and it's seen as greatly desirable by those who don't have it. Famously, many men in their 60s who have worked all their lives find it very difficult to adjust when they stop working. My father was one such. And I'm sure many of the older people in the audience will remember the famous cry of Yossa in the TV series Boys from the Black Stuff, "Give us a job," which was of course about unemployed people in the north of England. My talk is a personal overview of the changing conditions of work, and some continuities too, over my own lifetime. I've called it, as you saw, "From Fair Work to Work Fair," because I was argued that over that period, since I was born in 1945, social attitudes have changed. From a perspective that deemed it was the goal of a decent society to provide full employment for all its citizens and to reward a fair day's work with a fair day's wage, to one now which seems to have come to accept that a fair level of unemployment is inevitable, and at the same time blaming those people who fall into the unemployed as if it was their fault, as if their predicament was something to do with their weakness of character. And nowadays it's even punishing them for it by making them perform menial work for an amount below the minimum wage. You'll recall the example of the poor folk at the Jubilee who had to sleep under the bridge because they'd been bused down from Bristol and Southampton, where we come from, to work the security for the Jubilee Day. I think the notion of fairness is very important. A lot of workers talk a lot about fairness, and it's something that's very deeply embedded, I think, into our social attitudes. Interestingly, Australia, which is one, I think, of the better countries for working conditions, has recently passed a Fair Work Act, and I'm going to return to talk about that later. Okay then, so what am I going to do? My talk falls into four sections. I want to start by talking a bit more about work, what work means to us, and why we do actually, as a society, value it so highly. Then I'm going to continue by explaining why I believe that Britain, like many other countries, has suffered what I would term a deterioration of work. And this is a bit what Mr. Wirth was arguing in the little play which we've just seen. Then I want to look at the issue of low pay and why certain jobs seem to be seen as of low value or low worth, before briefly concluding with some comments about what I think needs to change. So let us start with this big question. Why does work matter so much, and what indeed is work? As Mary told you, I'm a sociologist, and we sociologists have actually spent a lot of time trying to define what work might be and found it rather difficult. A basic definition, which you can see there, is purposeful activity. But that could also apply to eating a very nice meal with one's family, or watching a football match. Those certainly are things of purpose. We have, in other words, to see that purposeful activity takes place in specific social and historical contexts. If we take the example of cooking, it could be a wage job if you're a chef or a caterer, or it could be housewife or housework if you're a mother or somebody who does the cooking for the family, or it could be a pleasurable hobby according to circumstances. So we can't just say it's activity. In general, sociologists, I think, decided that work is something we do regularly, that is structured and routinized, and which is carried out within certain specific time frames and under certain contractual conditions, so it's regulated and altogether constrained, which I think is the key bit. In other words, work is something we have to do, and we have to do it in certain ways. So it is not free time, which is why we often contrast work with leisure that is free time. I think it's because of this that when we talk about work in modern societies, we actually don't mean work in the broadest sense. We mean employment or wage labour. And sometimes self-employment is included by extension of the term. That's certainly what governments mean by work when they talk, for example, of we must get single parents back into work, as if looking after small children was not work, and very important work too. And that brings me to these two very important types of work, which also popped up in the playlist, domestic work and voluntary work. Two types of work which matter a lot, but which are not waged. And it seems to me significant that both of them are some ways seen as inferior. So you hear people say, I'm just a housewife. That's not so much anymore, but you certainly used to hear people say that. And voluntary workers said to me that they get told, of course, you're not a real worker, and we saw that again in the playlist. Because of all these difficulties in defining what work means to the individual, I think I would favour moving to this final definition, which is a sociological one, really. That is, looking at work as something within society. And then work becomes all the purposeful activity that's necessary to maintain and reproduce our society. And that can bring in the whole range of all the paid jobs, plus the vital contributions of the domestic workers and the voluntary workers. And why I like to look at work in this collective way is it also reminds us of the social necessity of work, of all the work we do, not just some high-status types. So the refuse collector, the lavatory cleaner, and the child miner matter just as much as do the doctor and lawyer. And one of the questions that I think we need to ponder at this conference is why we reward the latter so highly and the former so less well. As I said, when we talk about work nowadays, we're in fact mainly concerned with paid employment, so I am going to be concentrating on that in this talk. And the next point I want to discuss is why it's so important to people, apart from the fact that it takes up an awful lot of our waking hours. And here I'm referring to a classic study carried out by social psychologist Marie Yehuda in the 1930s. She studied a small town in Austria, Marienthal, where a plant had closed down and most of the population had lost their jobs. Yehuda's problem was to understand why the unemployed seemed to be so vulnerable to depression. And she concluded that employment offered a number of social goods or benefits, quite apart from and beyond income. And I've listed these here. Work gives us a time structure to our days. It gives us regular activity. It provides a status, standing in the world, and it's a source of social identity and sense of worth, which brings worth very strongly into the picture. It also brings us social contacts. It's well known that a majority of people do meet their partners, spouses, through work. And it also, very importantly, connects us to the wider society. So we feel part of that greater whole. Particularly striking to Yehuda and her research assistants when they studied the unemployed men was the way they struggled to fill in their days. She found that they might take an hour walking to the local shop, a journey which, for somebody in more of a hurry, would have taken about 10 minutes. Now, in terms of status, what is, I think, very important, and was touched on again in the playlist, is that those people who are outside the arrangements of wage labour are generally seen as in some way inferior. Above all, the unemployed, but also these other people, the retired, the sick and the disabled, the housewives. All these groups are to some extent seen as a burden on society because they have to depend for living on state benefits, i.e. our taxes. Look at the current attacks by the government on pensions, even though these pensions and the pension funds have been constituted out of the contributions of the workers themselves from their earnings. But it's above all the unemployed who are stigmatised and persistently characterised in the press as welfare scroungers. The portrayal is that they're lazy, happy to live lives of luxury funded by the state, even though research among young unemployed people shows that they desperately want jobs. A very interesting study was carried out by a geographer, Linda McDowell, who looked at unemployed working men in Cambridge. And she found that what they wanted for their futures was exactly the same as those people in employment. They all wanted a steady job, a house, a car and a family. And without that first thing, a steady job, it's very difficult to have the car, the house and the family. The question then becomes, what types of jobs could these unemployed people do? What jobs would they be and where would they come from? It is sometimes suggested that one of the problems is that people are picky and will reject certain types of jobs which are seen as too demeaning and too low paid. I would argue, however, that the major problem is still the actual lack of any jobs in certain areas and at certain levels. And this brings me into my second section of the talk, the deterioration of work. As we saw in the playlist, there has been a major shift in the nature of work during my lifetime. I grew up in the post-war period of rationing and eating pickled eggs and going to the sweetie shop to cash in my coupon to get a few sweets for the week. But subsequent to that, society did well and we moved to full employment in the 1960s. But since then, we have seen the steady decline of our manufacturing base and the development of what sociologists have termed a post-industrial economy. And in this process, a whole heritage of working life has been lost in certain parts of the country, particularly, of course, the North and Wales. I chose this as an example, which is a coal mine and a shipyard, because I've just been watching, and I don't know if any of you saw it, Grayson Perry's recent very brilliant television series on class and taste. In the first of these programmes, he talked to working class men and women in Sunderland. As Mary said, I worked there for 10 years, so it really rang true to me. These were people I'd taught. Grayson Perry found that the men he talked to were trying to seek to display their masculine pride and worth through a range of symbols, high-performance cars, elaborate tattoos, wrestling. These were displays to assert their masculinity. But they said to him that nothing really could substitute for what had been lost. And here I show you pictures of the work that took place in those locations. A picture of a miner, which brings home how very unpleasant that work was. Most of us, I think, would hate to go down a coal mine and would rather do almost anything else. The more skilled work of shipbuilding at the bottom, that's a picture of riveters. But the point here is the way in which this work was bound into the community, the local community. So this was a quote from one of the people who spoke to Grayson Perry. The coal mines and the shipyards could never be replaced for pride. Pride that you followed in your father's and grandfather's footsteps. And that's all demised. Shipbuilding bound the town together like religion. Interestingly, it was suggested that support for Sunderland Football Club was now the substitute for that community link for the industries. Football is perhaps a new religion. So things are different now, aren't they? Here are some pictures of typical work in the 21st century. That's the stock exchange with all those young men yapping away into their phones. Down there is a supermarket with a woman working on the checkout till. And this is a call centre. All of these jobs, of course, employing very new types of technology. Unfortunately, in my view, though, these new kinds of work, although the people doing them there may look a bit happier than the miner, are the picture overall is not a particularly positive one. Alongside the loss of good, well-paid jobs in industry, we're in the middle of a dismantling and reconstruction of the public sector, which is meaning the loss of good, stable jobs. Alongside this, we have the growth, again, of long-term unemployment, and where new jobs are created, they tend to be in low-paid service work. It's jobs such as retail, privatised social care, leisure and catering. All these trends I've mentioned have come together, it's argued, to create what the economist Guy Standing has called the precariat. That's the growth of a major proportion of people in our society who live in insecure and ill-rewarded work. And it's calculated that about a third of the current populace of working age is in this situation. These people are at risk of losing their jobs, and so they live in a state of struggle, anxiety about where the next penny is coming from, and stress. Among them, members of ethnic minorities are likely to be at particular risk, since our economy remains strongly segmented by gender and ethnicity, and that's one of the continuities one can note over the period I'm discussing. In general, women too are also likely to be in precarious jobs more than men. So in general, if we look at the labour market today, I would argue we can see a polarisation in jobs. At the top, we have an elite which is very highly paid, doing very well, very skilled. And then we have a marginalised group trapped in a low-pay labour market or unemployment. I'd also like to mention something which isn't very often remarked upon, but which I think is highly significant. That is the role of employment agencies, I mean private agencies, not the job centres, as gatekeepers to jobs, especially in the lower layers of the occupational structure. If you are among the precariat, it's through an agency that you will probably get a job nowadays. And that has really encouraged the spread of temporary employment, because agencies deal only with cover, not with permanent recruitment. In fact, if you get a job through an agency, I know this because my partner is in this unfortunate situation, you actually can't go on to take a permanent job at the place they find a job for you, because they will have to pay a huge sum to the agency. So it encourages insecurity, and it also helps push down wages, because of course the agencies have to make a profit out of it, so they take their cut. And I think that the spread of these agencies in Bristol, there seem to be about 50 different ones, and a new one opens every day, is a negative feature of our labour market. Why is all this happening? Well, we have to see it, of course, in terms of broader social developments, which arise from the globalisation that people have talked about and heightened international competition. Recently, it's been argued that the emergence on the international scene of new economic powers, such as China, particularly, and India, has led to what people call a race to the bottom. Which countries can produce goods and services more cheaply? And you can see that, of course, with the well-known move of call centres from Britain to India. This is also linked to the way different countries are placed in the international economic order. So, the United Kingdom, like other early industrialisers, in fact, of course, we were the first industrial nation, we have, it's been argued, been subject to this process of financialisation. That idea is that the basis of wealth creation in our society has shifted from production, from making goods in manufacturing, to making money by speculating in money, which is what our dear friends, the bankers and the hedge funds and all these people and the men shouting into their phones are doing. The Italian theorist Daniel Righi argues that leading economic nations all follow this trajectory of moving from manufacturing to finance as the basis of their economy, and that inevitably leads to decay and decline, because financialisation benefits the wealth creators, obviously, the very rich people who are making fortunes out of all this and earn millions, but it doesn't, on the whole, spread down through the society, and therefore it promotes recession. So what this means for us is, in terms of the jobs that we have in the UK today, is actually an increase in bad jobs. And I've put up this little slide just to summarise the characteristics of good jobs and bad jobs. Good jobs, the ones we all want, are high paid, secure, full time, unionised. There are career routes, and you find them in the professions. You used to find them in manufacturing, and you find them in the public sector services as well. And the people who work in these jobs have high skills. But at the other end, there are the low-paid, insecure jobs, part-time, they're not unionised, the dead end, you can't get promoted in them. They're often in private services, and people who do them are not, in my view, unskilled, but will be classified as unskilled, and we'll come on to that point later. Okay, the increase in these jobs then, I would argue, and the decline also in the quality of some good jobs, has had a deleterious effect on people's subjective experience of working. In an ideal world, people would, as we suggested, find a sense of worth and value in their employment. And I like this quote that I found in a recent American book: all employees must be treated with dignity and respect. to seek meaning, one has to feel like a human being, and I'm sure we'd all agree with that. Unfortunately, that isn't exactly what's happening at the moment. Surveys, for example, in my own area of employment, the university sector, increasingly reveal negative experiences. Workers report insecurity, stress, lack of recognition by managers, a culture of bullying and micromanagement, and a climate of fear. For example, in my own institution, a respected university, where I am in fact a trade union activist, we've had a whole rash of cases of reported bullying, mainly concerning male managers, with the victims being women. And generally, staff, when they talk to us about their work, say that while they're jumped on for any mistake or failure, nobody ever seems to thank them for work done well. And yet how easy it is to say to somebody, thanks for doing that, that was really good. And it's something, I think it has been suggested that the British are not terribly good at this, and that other people like Americans are a bit better at acknowledging service. Also, because people are very worried at the moment of losing their jobs, rather rationally, there has developed in some institutions a kind of climate of fear where people worried about losing their jobs are driven to work very long hours in order to prove their worth to the firm. And thus, even for people in good jobs, work can become a burden and not a pleasure. There are other things that are happening which I would argue mean that these developments are not just bad for the people in the jobs, but also are bad for society. As long-term ghettos of unemployment consolidate, it tends to set in a spiral of decline, what has been referred to by social policy people as the broken windows syndrome. Once windows are broken, people don't feel respect for the rest of the environment, and it suffers. Local businesses collapse, shops are boarded up, criminal elements move in, drug cultures flourish, and more jobs are then lost. In such communities with concentration of people unemployed, underemployed, or struggling to survive on low incomes, many of the voluntary organisations and state-funded agencies who have offered support in the past have either lost their funding or have been forced to close. And the support for those stuck in this situation, I do believe to be truly inadequate. I challenge everyone to try surviving on £71 a week nowadays. That's what the job seekers' allowance is currently. What may emerge as a result of this, we have seen on the streets last summer, as those people who felt themselves to be excluded from social participation and consumption took law into their own hands, with dreadful consequences, as we know. Okay, so I want to move on now to talk about the low-pay economy, because research showed that those young men and women who did take to the streets and rioting were mainly either unemployed or employed in what I've called the low-pay economy. And I want to talk about this in this next part of my talk. The argument is quite simple. The people who are in these positions are actually deprived of social worth. Now, policymakers, when they're contemplating the problem of unemployed people, often talk about people having low self-esteem, which may be true in some cases, though I don't think it is in all. But what it does is put the blame on the low-paid and unemployed, as if there was something wrong with them, and therefore they can't make their way in the world. My argument is that these people, whatever their own psychological disposition, are actually being handicapped by low social esteem, the fact that we don't value them. And I wanted to illustrate this with what I thought was a particularly nice quote from somebody we recently interviewed in one of my studies, by looking at young men and women who are currently going through university. And this young woman was working as in a pizza restaurant. She comes from a working class background in South Wales and has to pay her way through university, so she has to work to pay the fees. And this is what she said. When I was a waitress, I got so many, "You're so stupid, you're so incompetent." There's still this really big thing, if you work as a waitress or in the shop, then you have nothing and your life's going nowhere, which is ridiculous, because even if that was the case, there's still no need to talk down to people, even if they were just going to work in the shop. It's their life. There's no need to think that they're less than you. And she felt this very strongly because the people she was moving among were rather rich young people who were able to spend their free time in study or leisure activities while she was struggling with a job which she hated. Some of you may have come across the work of Owen Jones, who wrote a book called Chaffs, and this book reveals the increasingly contemptuous attitudes that are shown to working class people by some in the higher regions of society, and stigmatising them by this term chav. Nobody quite knows what it stands for, but it's sometimes said to stand for council house and violent. And this is a term I have myself heard upper class students at Bristol use about the local people in Bristol. Peasants is another way they talk about them, because we folk in Bristol have a bit of an accent like. So, this is a thing that is very depressing, I think. Many of the working class students that we interviewed told us that the students from private schools considered that state school students were inferior and must be stupid, or they wouldn't have gone to a state school. And in the work sphere, the same attitudes were reported by a factory worker I interviewed some while ago in Newcastle, who simply said of the managers in his factory, "They treat us like bairns, as if we were children." Now, I think this is really important. You may feel that these are very slanted quotations, so I could produce more. But I think that there is a view of people in manual or less skilled work as stupid and unworthy. And that seems to me to be the reason why it appears that we believe that people only deserve to receive low rewards for their work efforts. And what to me is of particular concern is that so many of our young people now are increasingly likely to find themselves in this low-wage economy, especially those who don't have very high education backgrounds levels, or who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. So people are now talking about a lost generation of young people. A jilted generation is another term that has been written about, suggesting that the greed of the elder generation in hanging on to their jobs and not giving them up to young people has betrayed this whole generation. As you probably know, youth unemployment now runs at 22%, and in certain areas, among young black males, for example, it runs at 55%, which is a quite shocking statistic, I think. This is a growing trend. Some while ago, we carried out some research in Bristol among young adults, and we did a survey of over 1,000 of them, aged 20 to 34, back in 2000, which actually was a time when the economy was doing rather well, recovering from a previous recession. And when we analysed the results of our survey, we were really quite shocked by its findings. Of these young people, and Bristol, I may say, is a very prosperous city. It's rich, it's got two big universities, it's got a very strong media creative section, and it's also got lots of headquarters of business, of building societies and financial institutions. Nonetheless, among these young people, 54% had experienced unemployment, and 10% had experienced spells that lasted for 3 or 5 years. I contrast that with my life. I've had quite a sort of up and down career, but I never ever have been unemployed for a single day. I was always able to find a temporary job. I worked in a shop in London Road, actually, at one time. I worked in a sports shop, which may or may not be there, and I worked in a factory in Leicester, Gents Clocks, being the fine clerk, and in Portland Shoe, another Leicester place. So, you know, if I couldn't get a proper job as a teacher, which was my profession, I was able to find these things to prop me up. Not so anymore. And perhaps the most surprising finding of all, considering that our age group was 20 to 34, was that 63%, that's over half of them, had an income of less than £12,000 a year, which is not enough to get yourself, obviously, into the housing market. Although, of course, these were young people, and they had long futures in front of them, but we were concerned that so few of them had settled into a career which would provide them with the ability to secure a mortgage, and most of them were not in a position to have any kind of occupational pension because of their drifting around between jobs. So we feared that many would struggle in the future with poverty. Only a small proportion in the traditional elite professions, law, engineering and medicine, really had the kind of stable careers that people of my generation expected and looked for. Since then, of course, things have got worse. This is a bit pessimistic, I'm sorry, but it's difficult just at the moment, I think, to be terribly optimistic. Those were the good times, and since then the world economic recession has obviously hit young people across Europe, so that rates are as high as 40% and 50% in countries like Spain and Greece. This isn't just a material problem, obviously it does pose problems of how to survive, but also one that inevitably affects mental well-being. Young people are basically being told that society has no use for them, and the result is that they're seen as a burden on their families and a problem for society. It's not surprising if some of them turn to crime, drown their troubles in alcohol or drugs, or become depressed, even suicidal, and the rate of suicide among young men is quite high. In terms of low pay, I also wanted to talk about one other theme which I feel very strongly about, and that is the position of women in the labour market. From the time of the Industrial Revolution, women's work has been seen as of lower worth. Throughout the 19th century, wages for women's jobs were about one third to a half of men's wages, and that was right through till the beginning of the 20th century. Of course, since the Second World War, women have made steady progress, and the gender pay gap is now 18%, so we have seen a substantial and very welcome improvement. Nonetheless, certain types of jobs that women do are still lowly rewarded compared to the kind of jobs men do, and these are the jobs associated with care, jobs such as nursing, childcare, elder care. And it's interesting to speculate as to why this should be. Historically, it's been justified by the idea that the skills involved are somehow natural. Social anthropologists have pointed out the symbolic associations of women seen as natural and men as cultured. Consequently, the skills in jobs which seem as linked to men are viewed as cultural learned, you have to train for them, and therefore deserving of greater rewards. Where it's assumed that women just know how to care. But I think anyone who's had a small baby knows that actually it's something you have to learn, and it is quite skilled. I've talked with women in caring professions and others, and like others researching in this area, I've found how very strongly committed these workers are to their ill-paid jobs, because they put such high value on helping the less fortunate, making a difference. And I've shown here a couple of quotations here from some of our young students that we're interviewing, and these are young women, talking about why they want to work with children or go into teaching. It depends what you see as the rewards for work, as whether they're like monetary or like helping people gain knowledge. I've always enjoyed helping people that struggle with things. I like to listen to people, and I like to try and give them advice. So yes, maybe I'll go into counselling. So what we found among these young women was that already they were going in the direction of care rather than money and status. And it was a real contrast with the men students, all of whom, when we asked them what they wanted to do, talked of lots of money, jobs in the city, careers for promotion, working for one of the top firms. So this gender divide in choice of jobs is very, very striking. Well, my argument is that this kind of care work is absolutely vital for the well-being of society. Yet somehow we rate jobs of this kind much lower than those which involve handling money, such as the city, or technology, such as IT and engineering. I feel that a revaluation of our priorities is long overdue here, and yet actually the reverse is happening. As the public sector is rationalised and privatised, care workers are seeing their conditions degraded. I have a student, a PhD student, who's been doing some interesting work on the privatisation of elder care as the council sheds jobs and it's being shifted to private firms. The workers told her how their jobs were being regraded downwards, that they no longer got travel allowances to pay for moving between the homes of the clients they were looking after. What shocked me was that they weren't paid for the waiting time between clients, so they might have to sit in their car for 2 hours before they got to the next job that they were paid for. And their visits were now strictly timed and monitored. They had to get in there and out in half an hour, which meant that they couldn't take the time to look after the old people and build up the relationships, which was what they really valued in the job. So the picture that she painted was one which seemed to me so sad, both for the workers and for the old people whose care was being degraded. So my final section, could we do things differently? I've talked about deterioration and unfairness, and these are often seen when people argue, particularly economists, I have to say, to be inescapable and inevitable. There's talk of the law of the market, the nature of capitalism. Mrs. Thatcher famously said, there is no alternative. But I don't accept that argument, which is also sometimes put by people on the left as well as by Mrs. Thatcher. Because other nations show that we can do things in a more egalitarian and humane way. And I'm just going to conclude by mentioning two examples of this. The Swedish model, or Scandinavian model, and the Australian Fair Work Framework. In both of these countries, I've never been to Australia, and I'd like to, but I've been to Scandinavia and Sweden quite a lot and seen it at first hand. And in these countries, it seems to me that employees are treated with far more respect and dignity than we are. And the dignity of labour is acknowledged. And therefore, different kind of arrangements have developed between the worker, the citizens and the state. So in the Swedish model, which is known as active citizenship, all adults are expected to have a job and support themselves. And that applies to men as well, to women as well as men. But in order that this can happen, the state provides good education, including free higher education and vocational education, so that people who don't want a degree can find a good job with skills. And of course, notoriously, the Scandinavian countries provide free state childcare to enable women to go into jobs. And for those people who can't find a job and fall out of the workforce, a decent support is given to stop them degenerating and going into the kind of decline that I fear we see in some of our young excluded people. Now, Sweden's not an earthly paradise, although I think it's pretty well as close to one as I've come to. I actually prefer Norway because it's got better scenery, but both countries are very nice and very good for women. But, in fact, currently the Swedish youth employment rate is as high as ours, so they do have problems. Nonetheless, when I go there, I see that there isn't the kind of visible difference between the classes that you observe in Britain. It's very difficult in the street to tell somebody's background because they all wear the same clothes. They all wear black trousers and black shirts and tops. And the men, the businessmen, do wear suits and shirts, but they don't wear ties, because wearing a tie is seen as a sign of capitalist exploitation. It's quite interesting. So they have problems, but as I said, they respect all sorts of labour, not just those that bear such high status in our own society. And I think that's a major difference. A different sort of approach is in Australia, the Fair Work Act, which was passed in 2009. And I've used this example because I so much like the word fair. And this is an approach which is designed to balance the needs of employees, the unions and employers, what we often call the corporate system in Britain. And the Fair Work Act lays down a whole lot of what it calls a safety net for workers. It lays down things, I've mentioned a few of them here. There's a national work minimum standards, including a minimum wage, which is considerably higher than ours. It's the equivalent of £10.51, whereas our minimum wage is £6.08. And they talk about something called modern awards, by which they mean that one of the reasons why women get paid less than men is that historically trade unions have represented the interests of men through collective bargaining, because women haven't been so frequently unionised, they haven't had that advantage. So they've got this low-paid bargaining stream which tries to help those people who missed out on this past history. And these include workers in areas, they say this specifically in the Act, childcare, aged care, community service, security and cleaning, all those areas I've been talking about, the caring areas. They also provide for a balance between work and family life, with stronger requirements for flexible working arrangement than we have. They've increased the amount of unpaid parental leave available to both parents, and a new right to request an extension of unpaid parental leave. So there's an attempt there to get a balance. You have to have profit, you have to have organisation and control of employees, but you also have to ensure that there isn't exploitation, and that's what this Fair Work programme tries to do. So if we were to think of a utopia, as it were, which I like to do in order not to feel too gloomy about things, what should we do? Well, these are the things that I would like to see. I would like to see a real attack on low pay by a raised minimum wage, because £6 is not a lot, and of course a reduction of the absurd pay differentials which have developed over the last decades. That may be difficult to do, but the other things I think are things that we can do without the economists saying, no, it's not possible. I think we need a rehumanisation of work so that workers of all kinds are treated with respect and the value of their contribution, whatever it is, acknowledged. And that can be done so easily, as I've mentioned, by praise and acknowledgement and treating everybody as a human being. I've seen this trend in my own area, and I know it's been complained of elsewhere, of micromanagement and control replacing the autonomy and trust which workers value in their jobs, and I think we need to move away from that. That requires a shift in the perspectives and values of our employers and managers so that they become less distrusting, that they respect their workers and trust them to carry out their job and not to be idle and cheat, which I don't think most people do, certainly not the people I know. And finally, I think we need a rebuilding of the contract between individuals and the state, which has to reflect this fact that without the contributions of all of us, all the workers in all their different spheres, our society would be a lot poorer. Because work may be a necessary evil, but it's what makes, in the long run, a society where we can all be happy, free, and enjoy ourselves. Thank you.